We come to the eighth presentation. And last week, we talked about Chartres Cathedral for just a moment or so, and about the exquisite labyrinth maze that's there in the pivot of the cathedral. And so I brought a copy. This is the maze, and I'm handing out copies to those of you who are here. That is where the nave and the transept come together. And in order to navigate this maze, you enter from the east, and you must traverse the entire area before you can get to the center, so that the completeness and the perfection occur together. And it's the completeness of a natural cycle of pragmatic doing with the conscious ecology of perfecting the dimensions by which the doing is lifted into eternity. There are a number of interesting books on Chartres. This is the tried and true tour guide that you would get if you went there. And the world of Chartres has a beautiful color shot of the cathedral in the village. And I have brought a number of other volumes, including The Mysteries of Chartres Cathedral, that once upon a time was a Bodhi-tree free book. And so it was a gift from the very place that we are delivering our presentations. To go with this mandala is a second mandala, and this mandala is a mandala of shared presence. And it comes from the Navajo Indians, and it originally appeared in several illustrations to this Bollingen volume, where the two came to their father, a Navajo war ceremonial delivered by the great medicine man of that day. This was to send off the Navajo men to World War II. As you might know, Navajo was used as a code language during World War II for top secret codes for the United States, because it is impossible to learn Navajo unless you are brought up with the language. You cannot learn Navajo later because the language is peculiarly ancient. Very ancient North American Indian languages have fourth and fifth person declensions. They have time declensions that do not occur in European or Asian languages. And the commentary on this volume was delivered by Joseph Campbell. And there are illustrations inside. And this mandala with the opening at the top has two self symbols that are shared together, not just paired. If it were only paired, there would be a parallel, whereas the offset here is precise, so that only in the sharing does the opening give one the completeness of the shared form to allow for the center to occur then as a complementarity. One of these mandalas is about the Parayana. This is about the shared presence that makes reality out of the Parayana. I will just share with you, this is my spirit grandfather. This is Tatanga Mani, walking buffalo. He lived to be 97. And he adopted my spirit mother as his medicine daughter in Calgary, Alberta, in the early 1950s. And she adopted me as her spirit son in the early 1970s. If you can get a hold of the Alan Ladd Shelley Winters film, Saskatchewan, there's footage of Tatangamani on his horse wearing his buffalo skull headdress. And one of the names that I have is Triple Cloud from that. We're looking at the spread throughout the planet, throughout time, up until this very threshold that we inhabit now. And it is an extraordinary confluence and influence at the very same time. One of the most interesting documents from classical antiquity speaking to this is in a dialogue of Plato's, one of his latest, called the Philebus. Philebus was a scoffer, a professional scoffer. But Socrates, in his high Socratic dialogue with Protarchus and Philebus, shows that there was something that had happened several generations before. In fact, it becomes to Socrates his spirit grandfather, because he had a spirit mother who adopted him, whose name was Diotima. My spirit mother's name was Madame Valda. She was half Russian gypsy and half Spanish gypsy, and grew up in Nice on the Mediterranean Sea. Socrates' spirit mother, Diotima, was from Mantinea in the northern part of the Peloponnese, and she was an original member of the Pythagorean community. So that Pythagoras was a spirit father, grandfather for Socrates. And so Plato, in the Philebus, has Socrates say that some special Prometheus brought a special insight fire to man. And the insight fire that was brought is that there is a primordial complementarity. The primordial complementarity is between the Greek word for the first one is peras, which means limited. The second word is apeiron, which means unlimited. And that once one has the complementarity between limited and unlimited, a second tuning polarity comes into play, the odd and the even. And once one has the four directions, a pair of pairs, one now has for the first time a template which allows for one to both put things together. The Greek word for that is synagoge, like in synagogue. It means literally collection. And the later Hellenistic Jewish use was not collection, but congregation. The synagogue is the congregation, not the building, the congregation. The word that is complementary to synagogue is diaeresis, which means division. And it is the interplay between synagogue and diaeresis that is the dialectic. And the way in which the energy is formed is between the odd and even moving in this dialectic And the high wisdom that gives it a context of reality is because the limited and unlimited, the peros and the aperon, are forever, eternally, there in their tuned. And so in the Philebus, Socrates says, this gives a special circumstance not only to number, but to music, because music then will have a very interesting way of presenting itself. It will have two tetrachords, two fours, that work together. Sometimes they work together as a set of seven, and sometimes they work together as a set of eight. So that in the deeper Pythagorean music that came to characterize classical Greek and eventually the music of the classical world was that there are 15 notes in this combined set. However, one of the notes reoccurs, and secretly, if one really were able to differentiate to perfection, you would find out there are 16. The key to it is that in the octave, do, re, mi, fa, so, la, ti, do, there are seven notes in a set. The eighth note, making it an octave, is actually the first note, but in a higher registry, a higher key. And that the interpenetration, then, of the scalars allows for it to have a seamless continuity that can also be distinguished through patience and accuracy to be precise. It is a double octave that presents itself as an overlapping of an octave and a seven-note set, and that one has to be able to utilize your consciousness to be able to jump to higher dimensions in order to know that. That in terms of a four-dimensional world, you will never be able to know that because you don't have enough dimensions to understand further than simply the limit. And if you bring into play the field of consciousness, the unlimited, the infinite looking upon the integral, the infinite as a differential looking upon the integral, needs to have a prism in order for this to be diffracted, as it were. And that prism is the spiritual person. The spiritual person who is not simply the individual of the symbolic structure of identity, nor the character that's there in the experience of your mythic horizon life, feelings and language and images, based upon the identified things of the world, the phenomena of the world, the ritual actions that one does, the things existentially that one works with, that cycle in four-dimensional space-time cannot be realized without a quintessential fifth dimension of consciousness, but it will not register with any kind of astrophysical spectrum until there is a prismatic person, the art of spirit person making, who is able to do this. And when the facet cutting has gone far enough, the shape of the prism becomes jewel-like. And in that jewel-likeness, their scope is not only to have vision, consciousness, but to be able to apply the vision to changing the dimensions of space-time, the dimensions of the world, and by using themselves as the prismatic pivot by which this transformation occurs. In this way, the spiritual person has a very special place in higher dimensional ecology, because not only is it that one's spirit person is able to prism transformations of almost everything, it is a shareable quality. It is a shareable dimension. And so while there is a parayana open to an expandable community, the index is the shared presence between two initially. Hence the saying, direct from the master. Wherever two or more are gathered together in my name, I will be there. The resolving third occurs because of the complementarity. And that complementarity is not only tunable, but it makes the music of the universe into a cosmos. And the cosmos sings because the first penetration is through sound. When you get into really high yoga in India, one discovers that the origin is not visual, but is audio. And that initial, before sound, silence, which allows for sound to be note discursive, because the silences are the timing in between the notes that give the music its scalars, its cadence, its rhythmic expression. The Sanskrit word for that was sphota, S-P-H-O-T-A. And one rarely finds the explication of this in books. One of the earliest expressions in English was from Surendranath Dasgupta, who was the resident genius in Calcutta, whose five-volume, eventually, History of Indian Philosophy was published by Cambridge University Press. The first volume came out about 1921-22 and was such a success because it opened up the refinement of Indian spirituality to generations who were used to having translations by British Empire Army officers and not somebody who was calibrated to the nth degree of sophistication from the Indian tradition itself. The first Westerner to go to Surendranath Dasgupta to study individually was the young 19-year-old Mircea Eliade from Romania, from Bucharest. And he got a special little financial help because as a precocious teenager, he had written a very interesting novel. He wrote several interesting novels. And of course, until then, he had spent all of his money on books. He lived in the family attic, and his library was up in the attic of the family house. And he sold his library and used the funds that were coming in from the published novel to go to India and to study with Dasgupta. And being 19, just on the verge of being 20, and being an extraordinary young man, he, of course, fell in love with the beautiful daughter of Surendranath Dasgupta, who said, "You are here to learn a spiritual path, not to look for some kind of date." And so Dasgupta did what a good spiritual teacher will do. He sent Eliade out of Calcutta, out of Bengal, to the far north of India, to Rishikesh, where the professional yogis there for thousands of years did what they always do with precocious young whippersnappers. They proceeded to break him and then break the bits and then dissolve the broken bits until there was literally nothing left. Next week, I'll bring two photographs. One of the young Mircea Eliade at 19 when he went to India, and one of the 21-year-old Mircea Eliade when he came back to Europe. And the difference is startling. He has a full beard. He has the yogic concentration. And later on, he was able to do a tuned pair of books that were extraordinary. And they came out in the late 1940s. One was called Shamanism, and the other was called Yoga. The yoga is the limited. The shamanic is the unlimited. And when one reads them together, one begins to get the dialectic that goes back to ancient wisdom, at least by the time of Pythagoras, it was able to be brought out. The time of Pythagoras, of course, is the time of the threshold of the historical Buddha, of Lao Tzu, of Ezekiel, of the rediscovery of Zarathustra, as Zoroaster. So there are threshold moments that are part of time forms. And when a time form has its fulfilling accumulation, the expression comes out in terms of the accumulated penetration that now becomes a resonance that unfolds in the next time forms. Comparable to 500 BC for the appearance of Jesus is the Florentine Renaissance for us at the beginning of the 21st century, about 500 years. The genius at that time was a young Florentine named Marsilio Ficino. And his patron was Cosimo de' Medici, who was a character who had made arrangements. He was in family squabbles and wars, and he was put into exile and sent out of Florence, and he went to Venice. And while he was in Venice, being Cosimo de' Medici, even young, he made all the arrangements for the Medici international banking families to accept all of the refugees from Constantinople, which was falling to Mahmud the conqueror. And so all of the books and teachers that had been esoteric in the Byzantine world since the 3rd century AD all came through the funnel of Cosimo de' Medici's arrangements, and all of the choice books came to him first for offering, and this is how a big, huge volume of Plato in Greek came into Cosimo de' Medici's hands. And he realized there had only been one dialogue available in the medieval centuries for almost 1,000 years, the Timaeus. All of a sudden, he had dozens of Plato. He decided he needed to have a special translator to be able to read Plato unedited by superficiality and presuppositions. So he chose the young son of his personal physician, and Marsilio Ficino was trained specifically to translate Plato, to understand Greek in this Pythagorean, Socratic, Diotima, Plato, Aristotle, and so on, so that he could understand the full spectrum of what is being presented here, what is in need of being translated. When Cosimo was dying, 1464, on his deathbed, he had Marsilio Ficino read to him the Philebus about the peras and the aperon, the odd and the even, the ways in which wisdom, when it is truly understood, allows for us to have a very special celebration. The celebration is to have a communion meal together in celebration of the lineage which has come down to us, which we continue because we are now able to pass it on. That if we were not able to pass it on, it would not really have come to us. Because when it really comes to us, it comes to go through us. It is prismatic of the light to go through the prism and give the spectrum. The only way one gets a spectrum is not to have some artificial backing which then makes the mind a mirror and does not give you a spectrum, it gives you the repeat of the image, the repeat of the world. And so a mirror mind is a sign of being artificial in the extreme. And one finds in Middle Ages, again and again, they use the term, Latin term, speculum, the mirror of this, the mirror of that. Whereas in the Renaissance, it was not the mirror, but getting rid of the false background and allowing for the light to go through. And when it does, one realizes one can see in terms of perspective, in terms of ratios and proportions, and not only see, but hear. And one of the great Renaissance creations, the first architect to really be able to begin working with this was Leon Battista Alberti, but the architect who perfected it was Andrea Palladio. That is to be able to make a music room. One of Satyajit Ray's great films in India is in translation called The Music Room. A Renaissance Pythagorean music room is a pair of cubic rooms, 20 feet by 20 feet by 20 feet. And when you pair them together, you get a room which is 40 feet by 20 feet by 20 feet. We're lucky here in Los Angeles because on the second floor of the Huntington Mansion in the Huntington Library and Gardens is a classic Renaissance music room. And as soon as you walk in, you will sense, you will hear the amplitude of a perfect proportioned architecture, which allows any sound to be located clearly, but also that it is surrounded consciously by the silence which is there with it in a pair of interesting ways. One is that there is an overtone, and the other is that there is an undertone, so that a musical note has three levels, and not just itself. It isn't that one follows the notes like following the dots. That's an artificial construct. It's that the dots occur within an open space, and when they're arranged in a special geometricity, the ratios of their openness will resonate in freedom. One now has not just noise, one has music. We're looking at presentation 8 in a set of 13 that has 6 presentations on either side of presentation 7, which is a pivot, which allows for the tunability, which allows for an interesting noumenon to occur, that once the set of 13 is presented so that you are able to hear that the seventh is a pivot, the silence before and the silence after will complete that kind of double octave, and you will have a 15-part set because the parentheses themselves will be a part of the set, the parentheses of silence. This is called High Dharma. We're going to hear a couple of lines of High Dharma from about 1960 years ago. This is the sixth ode from the Odes of Solomon by Mary Magdalene. This is the English translation of James H. Charlesworth, who is now at Princeton at the time he was at Duke. As the wind moves through the harp and the strings speak, so the Spirit of the Lord speaks through my members, and I speak through his love. For he destroys what is alien, and everything is of the Lord. For thus it has been from the beginning and will be until the end. You can see that there is not only a geometricity, but there is a trigonometry of ratios and proportions and relationalities, and that can be raised to a third level of extra complexity, because it has now not only the space-time dimensions of geometry and the fifth and sixth dimensions of the field of vision and the prismatic person, but it has now a seventh and eighth dimension of kaleidoscopic conscious history, and the eighth dimension, the scientific analyzable cosmos. And that when those four dimensions of the ecology of consciousness are put into complementarity with the four dimensions of space-time, that eight reveals a ninth dimension, which is their complementarity. One of the lost esoteric hermetic dialogues is entitled "The Eighth Reveals the Ninth." This dialogue was specifically edited out of the hermetic set in the 360s AD. We know because this dialogue was part of the Nag Hammadi find in 1945 in Egypt. Nag Hammadi is an Egyptian village on the Nile, and a series of books were found there, and the eighth reveals the ninth occurs in Codex number 6 out of the 13. This is a translation by Louis Kaiser done in 1974. It's very rare. Self-published Academy of Arts and Humanities Monograph Series number 1, and quite exquisite. What he leaves out, though, is that in the Nag Hammadi material, what was found with the eighth reveals the ninth was a hymn, which is called the Prayer of Thanksgiving, which is the adjunct to the eighth reveals the ninth. And the hymn reads like this. I'll start it, and then after the break, we'll finish it. This is the prayer that they spoke. We give thanks to thee. Every soul and heart is lifted up to thee. O undisturbed name, honored with the name God, and praised with the name Father, for to everyone and everything comes the fatherly kindness and affection and love, and any teaching there may be that is sweet and plain, understand thee, speech, so that we may expound thee, knowledge, so that we may know thee. We rejoice, having been illuminated by thy knowledge. We rejoice because thou hast shown us thyself. We rejoice because while we were in the body, thou hast made us divine through thy knowledge. We'll finish it when we come back from the break. What we're looking at is that we are not only at the end of a great cycle, but telescoped within it are the ends of all of the other kinds of time forms. All of them came to an end in 1991. If you like to see an apocalyptic picture, take a look at the American troops traipsing between Kuwait and Iraq with 600 oil fields on fire at the same time, and the plumes of the black oil smoke making a black sky, and everyone having to wear gas masks because it was impossible to breathe on this planet at that time in that place. The mirror-backed mind thinks of things like 2012 or this or that. We are already almost 19 years into a whole series of new time forms. And it is exquisitely important because the 19-year cycle is a special overtone of the lunar cycle. While the lunar cycle happens every 28 days, the new moons also make it a 30-day parenthetical cycle. But the overtone is that the cycle of the lunar movement in the true cosmos goes through a larger ecology every 19 years. This was an architectural wisdom that was known to the builders of Stonehenge 4,500 years ago. We'll talk about Stonehenge next week. For now, let's take a break.